The GAA Hour with Colin Parkinson is sponsored by AIB, proudly backing club and county.
I'm not finished yet, it took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
All right, you're welcome along to the GAR. This is the football show sponsored by AIB. It's just myself and Keen in the studio today. Conan, I'd love to say he's hiding somewhere, but he's not. He had this day booked off, and it's just as well. Maybe he was just bravado and he saw the writing on the wall and he booked the day off just in case. But he really has egg on his face, and Stephen McDonald has egg on their face. They both tipped Tyrone to win. I have a little bit of egg on my face because I thought Tyrone plus three was a good bet. Nobody saw the hammering coming, and really it's always hindsight to look back and say, when you think about it, all my analysis that I said last Thursday was gearing towards Dublin winning and winning well, but then the prediction kind of just went Tyrone plus three. I don't know. It's easy to see it coming after the fact.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's always very easy after the fact to see these things. But God, no, we didn't expect it to be such a cakewalk for Dublin. But yeah, all of the things that we spoke about probably throughout the championship about these different styles of play and defensive systems and playing that way against Dublin and Croke Park and basically trying to set yourself up to damage limitation type stuff, and Dublin are just too good for that. They're too well prepared. Their management team were going to be, they knew exactly what Tyrone were going to do and they were going to be able to counteract it. And all of their methods of play throughout the league, we've seen it on several occasions. We've spoken about it ad nauseum here, staying really wide, dragging the defence out of positions and then relying on their power and one-on-one ability to just make Tyrone look such an ordinary team. Yeah. You know, for a team that clearly are not, like, they have excellent footballers in that Tyrone team, but they just couldn't get to the pitch of Dublin at all.
They made Tyrone look like Tyrone made Armagh look like, and that's, you know, like, they were just outstanding. We'll get into loads of analysis about that game because Dublin were just breathtaking, especially in the first half when you imagine Tyrone's intensity should have been, you know, right there. Good few funny things happened over the weekend, Keane. I want to run down through them with you. The one that's freshest in my mind, don't know if you watched the Sunday game last night. Did you watch it?
No, I told you.
I'm
banning myself from watching it.
Well, one of the reasons I don't watch it is like Des Cal does my head in sometimes with some of his questions, but he actually asked Kieran Whelan last night, did he ever mark Sean Kavanagh or did he ever play against Sean Kavanagh? Christ almighty, their careers overlapped by 8 years. They were the two of the best midfielders in the country pretty much for 8 years, and he asked Kieran Whelan, did you ever play against Sean Kavanagh? Right, that's the first funniest thing. Second thing, this is not in any sort of order, these are just funny things happened again. Hill 16 cheered Eric Lowndes entering the field. Now, thought it was Dermot Connolly. Now listen, if you don't think this is a classic, number one, because the stereotype Dublin Hill 16 numpty is a fella who follows Manchester United, lands down to Croke Park late because he's in the pub watching the soccer. This is what us culties absolutely, we live on this stereotype. And I've been on Hill 16 and it's not like that. There's obviously that stereotypical Dublin fan there. But we love this as culties. And yesterday, I couldn't stop laughing.
That was absolutely brilliant. I heard it and I was thinking, no, this can't be right. Like, they can't honestly think that this is Connolly. Like, this is ridiculous.
Now, one fella sent me a picture of the two of them side by side. Now, their faces look very like, but they couldn't see their faces. Like, Lowndes is clearly a smaller version of Connolly. Connolly's a much bigger man and he looks different than Lowndes.
For God's sake, look, you don't need numbers or jerseys. Fans
to know your players. You know your players, yeah. So the big joke is like that the lads on the hill were shouting, go on Wheelo, after Wheelo had retired. And J.O., they all lasted a few years after they retired because of these fellas. But anyways, it was a classic. Hill 16, you're never going to live it down. That's just there now. You thought Lowndes was Connolly and that's it. Right. Barry Kelly kicked the kick out over the 45-metre, out over the end line for a 45-metre line. Like, another absolute classic from the weekend. He kicked a kick out. I'm just going to repeat this. Well, most people listening will have seen the match. He kicked his kick out for a 45. Like,
it was so casual, it looked like a tactic.
Yeah.
Through the left foot at it.
I mean, Jarlett Burns was on the show earlier on this year. Like, I mean, people are very defensive about rule changes. And all Jarlett wants to do about the kick-out rule is to change it so it has to go forward. Like, I mean, the idea that you can kick it backwards to a corner back, like, it looks farcical. It doesn't help slow build-up play. And even if you make it go forward, it adds a huge another dimension to, you know, to the kick out. And we're not saying it has to go to midfield or anything of the sort. The mark is there to encourage that, but it should have to go forward.
Yeah, absolutely it should. I mean, look, it does look absolutely ludicrous, but you can see it's a very obvious tactic that's being employed now, particularly in Croke Park. Teams that play there a lot, you know, the likes of Mayo and Dublin particularly good at it. You know, David Clark put a number of kickouts where he just kind of lobbed them almost along the 14-yard line, or, you know, it's you're watching, you're thinking, God, this is dodgy stuff. But look, they're using what they can at the minute. I think it is a really good idea to bring that in, something like that, because look, at the top level of the game, some of these things are fine and they work out because you're people that are actually capable of doing them. Like, if this sort of nonsense starts creeping down the grades into club football, I mean, it will take away from it, from the game as a sport and from an enjoyable sport to play and watch down at your local field with your local club.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'd love if that came in. And
who the hell would want to see that in an under 14 or an under 16 game? Because that's where you'll see it next.
And it's probably started because it is full press, so that obviously when they press that much that,
but,
you know,
but like, this is the thing, like, I mean, that's what everybody did their whole lives. Everybody, you marked your man and you put, and when
there was always a press
out, there was always a press. Like, I mean, we get into all this terminology, you know the press and transition and restarts, not a kick out now. You know what I mean? Like, there's a new jargon for all this sort of stuff, and I suppose we have to do our best to try and analyse it in a language that people understand, I suppose, and that's maybe where it comes from. But the fundamentals of all of these, of the sport, hasn't changed.
Yeah, but the press obviously came since 2011, where teams were conceding kickouts, and suddenly something that always was the case in GAA is now being called a tactic and a press. Because
what you genuinely see now is teams that are used to playing with a wide range of numbers back and in a zonal defensive shape can't mark man to man, and they're totally at sea when they're one on one with their direct opponent. They don't have the basics of defending, or it's so it would appear.
And we're going to talk about that, because when Tyrone actually went a little bit more offensive in the second half, still not that offensive, they left three forwards up, they left loads of space because they weren't able to defend without the number of bodies that they usually have. Like, I mean, it was crazy to look at. Another quick one is Jim Gavin said he hasn't seen Mayo play since Dublin played them in the league in March.
I heard that one.
Now, do you believe that guff out of Jim Gavin? Like, Jim Gavin's a GEA man. Whatever my criticism of him, I'm not, and definitely no criticism of him as a manager. He's a ruthless manager. He's a Brian Cody type manager. He, like, what he did to Bernard Brogan yesterday, I think, was completely out of order. But how Dublin played is just a compliment to him and his management team, and like, they were unbelievably good. So, but for Jim Gavin as a GEA man, first and foremost, which he is, to say that he hasn't seen Mayo play Galway, he hasn't, when he never might have thought they were playing him, he hasn't seen him play Derry on the telly, hasn't seen him play Cork, maybe, unless he doesn't have Sky Sports subscription. he hasn't seen him play Kerry both days. Now, you could maybe understand why you didn't watch Kerry Mayo the day before. They could have had a get-together or a kick-around or whatever. You don't know what Dublin were doing or the schedule. But I just cannot comprehend that an inter-county manager wouldn't be watching other inter-county teams.
The enigma that is Jim Gavin, I don't know.
Do you believe it?
I don't know what I believe with him anymore. I don't know. Like, I don't know whether he's almost becoming a caricature of himself. It's funny. It's a genuine thing. Maybe he hasn't watched them. Maybe he's just not bothered. You know, there's a lot of professional soccer players who, by all accounts, have no interest in watching soccer or getting involved with anything to do with the game when they're away. It's just a job to them. Maybe Jim spends so much time dealing with Dublin. Maybe he's involved with his own club at underage level and he doesn't have time for that at the weekend. I couldn't possibly comment on his schedule.
Well, I don't believe it anyway.
You don't buy it anyway.
We'll move on. Another one. Oh, yeah, the minor man of the match was announced in Croke Park as person of the match. What's going on with the world? That's what I want to know. We won't have to spend too much time on that. But if it's coming to the stage where a man of the match is being called a person of the match, I don't know. The tail wagging the dog. Right, another one. Tyrone breaking away from the parade so that they wouldn't have to march in front of Hill 16. Now, I haven't seen it before. I thought it was a good one. Like, it didn't work out too well for them. So they started under the Hogan Stand, went all the way down to the canal end, turned the whole way in front of the canal, came back up in front of the Cusick. Usually they march in front of the hill and come back to where they started and break away then. They broke at the end of the Cusick Stand. They refused to walk in front of Hill 16, which I haven't seen a team doing before, and obviously just puts the thoughts psychologically and let's get one up on them and all this kind of thing. Why didn't they march in front of the hill? Maybe because of the huge reception the Dubs get over off Hill 16 and they didn't want to be any part of it. I don't know, like, you'd have to ask Tyrone. It did them no good, but it was still just another way of maybe, you know, sports psychology and let's do this. And maybe the hill booed them when they ran back down to the canal end, so we were in a huddle down the canal end by the time the Dubs had finished parading in front of Hill 16. But I hadn't seen that before.
I can't figure that one out. I don't see how it would make any blind bit of difference. In fact, as a player, irregardless of which team is getting the cheer, you're both walking side by side, so they could just as well be cheering for you. It actually doesn't make a difference. And you know, you can get energy from a crowd. Everybody knows when you're playing. You can get energy from something that happens in the game, from your teammate doing something, but also from the crowd and the reaction of the crowd. So, to my mind, it would actually be more beneficial to do the whole thing. You're either in it or you're not. Either do the parade or don't do the parade. Like, it's, to me, the parade is always a load of nonsense anyway. Never really thought much of them.
I enjoyed it. I loved them. I loved the parade. It's one of my favourite memories of playing football, is that moment in the parade where you look around and soak it in and actually go, Jesus, this is what it's all about.
I suppose it is the one opportunity you do get. I don't think it has any bearing whatsoever on performance after that. I mean, people who are pointing to those things, they obviously have serious mental weakness to start with, if that's something they're going to point to. As
maybe it was an effort of winding Dublin up, or, you know, I don't know.
Like, these things don't work. I mean, against Dublin. They're too well prepared. I mean, the only thing that might work is if one of them got a box in the mouth or something. I mean, because everyone has a great plan until they get a punch in the face. That's the great phrase. So, I mean, unless they're going to take it to that extreme, walking away on the parade, I don't think that's going to bother the Dubs too much.
No, definitely not. Right, well, Sean Kavanagh retired yesterday. It was a very tough day at the office for him. Obviously, arguably the player of his generation since 2003, when he made his debut, played corner forward underage and just turned into a sensation of a midfielder. Funnily enough, he tweeted his retirement plans last night, and it's been favoured at about 10,000 times, and he's got congratulations and well wishers from a host of different ex-players, huge amount. Now, he's only replied back to 5 people. So he replied back to Stephen Ferris, something about golf. He replied back to AP McKay, Henry Shefflin, all the heavy hitters, Kieran Whelan. You could argue Kieran Whelan's lucky enough to get into that company. And Paul Collins of Today FM was the 5th one. So I don't know how Paul Collins got into that, or maybe whether Sean is planning on thanking everybody individually, but maybe just the big hitters got the thank you.
Maybe they just gave him a nicer message.
Maybe. Well, that was definitely included, but Sean Kavanagh retiring isn't included in the funny moments from the weekend. Paul Collins getting into that elated company probably is. But, you know, an unbelievable player. And it's probably, I'd say maybe he gets the closure he wanted, because Mayo last year, you know, should have gone either way, and he thinks there's unfinished business. He kind of realises now, we ain't winning no All-Ireland with this Dublin team around, and I can bow out pretty gracefully with a clear conscience, and I don't want to mark anyone like James McCarthy ever again, because Dublin putting James McCarthy on Sean Kavanagh was another masterstroke from Jim Gavin.
Yeah, it was an excellent move. And look, we've all seen Kavanagh over the years, incredible player, played against him on a good few occasions. And he was always a player, I suppose, from on the opposing team that you wanted to make sure he had as quiet as afternoon as possible. And he was involved in a brilliant, brilliant Tyrone team and has had a fantastic career. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
great move from Dublin to stick McCarthy on him, because
definitely
what you have is, you know, a guy a good bit younger than him and just able to nullify his effect on the game.
And he completely did. There's no doubt about that. And James McCarthy would probably give, the only one I see giving James McCarthy trouble is Donegal Walsh. Donegal Walsh wasn't at the races against Mayo because he looked like he was injured, but we'll talk that in a minute as well. Quick one before we move on to the football, Keane, is whether Dublin are going to be split into two. And I know this is the usual, we'd be accused of this usual reaction, but this is a quote from Colin Colm O'Rourke yesterday. It must have been on the Sunday game. I was just reading it today. And he says, the future of the GAA cannot be one team in Dublin with 1.25 or 1.3 million, a third of the country's population. The health of the game in Dublin will be better served by two or three teams at adult level. It will give far more players at underage level, give players the chance to play for Dublin, and that is what they want. So that's just repeated there. It will give them far more. Now, you have to look at this. On the Sunday game last night, I was watching it. They had picked a starting forward line of the players that didn't start, and it was Flynn, McManaman, Connolly, Brogan, O'Gara, Costello. Like, Michael Darmacaulay and Bernard Brogan didn't even see game time yesterday. Now, these are two former players of the year. Now, just break this down, and this isn't anti-Dublin, and it isn't a knee-jerk reaction to Dublin, you know, hammering. They'll probably win three in a row this year. Well, they'll be the bookies' favourites. You have to look at the bigger picture here, and this is for all underage players in Dublin and what kind of a chance they have of playing inter-county football. Only the very, very elite. And the population, while it's an advantage, it's a huge disadvantage for young people trying to play inter-county football. And that's minor, under 21, senior, even the development squads. They could have 200 young fellas going for a squad of 20, 25. Leash might have 50. So immediately you're at a massive disadvantage. So there's so many players in Dublin that are not getting to play GAA at the highest level. If Dublin was split in two, the All-Ireland could easily be the way they have their house in order, Dublin versus Dublin. It would not surprise me. Like, in 10 years' time, it easily could be. So it's not anti-Dublin. Dublin will still be unbelievably strong. It gives way more players a chance, and it makes sure the Bernard Brogans, the Michael Darren McCauleys, like the Paul Flynns, the Alan Brogans, who all might have to retire too early because there's new lads coming through, gives them more of a chance maybe with a smaller pick of having a bit more longevity to their careers. It's not an anti-Dublin suggestion, I don't think.
No, well, look, I suppose I remember reading something from Colm O'Rourke as well, and it's a good few years ago. I mean, this isn't something that he's come up with off the hop. I mean, this is something that he had floated out there a long time ago, long before Dublin had this dominance at senior level. You know, just, and it's purely based on population and playing numbers, I suppose, and stuff like that. And the number of players at these clubs is actually mind blowing. I suppose, you know, when you're from, I suppose, a rural community or something, you just can't comprehend this. You know, just the numbers that they have, and look, you look at the opportunity being provided to people, and you know, I just can't understand or can't even fathom how they can give, you know, opportunity to all the kids that will want to play the game. Now, look, we all know that top level sport is not for everybody, and it is for the elite. And maybe it means that the Dublin County Board need to massively look at their structures of their club game, particularly, I mean, their club championships.
They've changed that for next year now. They've gone to round robins.
Yeah, like, that definitely needed to happen, but there could be a lot more emphasis put onto that from their side of things. But look, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that you could have four county teams represented, you know, within Dublin, and they could be the four All-Ireland semi-final. I mean, like, just do the maths on it.
All you have to do is
look at the numbers. And it is, and make no mistake, when people have their house in order and when you have good people in any organisation, it's a numbers game.
It's a numbers game, and this is the thing. And people always say, oh, this is cyclical, it's going to turn around. Well, Leinster hasn't turned around for God knows how long, since Laois won 1-0-3, Westmeath 0-4. You're the only ones to broke the cycle of Dublin Leinsters. That's showing no signs of turning around. There could be another 15 on ahead, so the Leinster Championship is a dead duck.
It is at the minute. And what's also happened is that this sort of stuff that Dublin are doing when they're absolutely annihilating teams, right? What it's also doing is
demoralising everyone
completely
else.
Completely demoralising other teams. So, for example, if you were a player from another county and you were on the borderline of whether you'd maybe go back and give the commitment to play county football or not next season, you would probably look at that and say, what's the point? Like,
yeah.
You know, genuine. And that's a terrible thing to say. But the whole purpose of any sort of sporting field is that you're trying to make it as even as possible. Like, the GAA have the control of that at county level in terms of they have an ability to try and level the playing field. Now, we don't really bore the gang, go down a structures debate about, you know, how the championships are run and that, but ultimately that's where this whole thing is going to go. It won't happen, probably won't happen now, but it is going to come down the track that as an organisation, the GAA are going to have to look at it and say, our key competition, the thing that people around the country love and all want to watch, you know, our All-Ireland Championships and the county game as the pinnacle of that. And if that becomes sort of non-competitive, which it kind of is already, in terms of you only have maybe 2 to 3 teams, I think people have now moved to the stage where they're kind of saying that's not good enough anymore.
Yeah,
you know,
they're kind of taking advantage of GAA people's blind loyalty and incredible passion and enthusiasm for the games, and that's it. They can put whatever they want out. But just another thing on the Dublin thing before we move on and talk about the games is that the idea that, oh well, this is a Dublin golden generation, you know, and this kind of thing, like these Connollys won't be around forever and these Bernard Brogans. Like, you look at the team from 2011 that won the first All-Ireland, that this team, people think this is this team. Like, it's about 3 different teams. But, like, the 2 Brogans, Dermot Connolly, Paul Flynn, Michael Darren McCauley, Dennis Bastic, Rory O'Carroll, Barry Cal, Brian Cullen, there's Kevin Nolan, there's a lot of other lads that are involved there. To me, they were the golden generation, in my eyes. Like, that Flynn, Connolly, Michael Darren McCauley, the Brogans, they were the Dublin golden generation. Now there's another Dublin golden generation, and... like, if you're a betting man, there's going to be another golden generation because the structures are right, they're churning them out, and you've a situation where Michael Darren McCauley and Bernard Brogan don't even get a run in an All-Ireland semi-final. And like, it's a good chance it could be these 2 lads last year. And like, I mean, they'd be the top forward on any other county for the next 3 or 4 years. Like, but they're going to be lost to the game because you can only pick 15 players from a population of 1.3 million. And I do think Dublin are missing a trick for the promotion of the game. I know winning helps promote the game, but there's so many dropping off and so many not going to be involved. And Bernard Brogan, Michael Darren McCauley, I'll remind you again, and Paul Flynn only getting on as a sub, he looked unbelievable when he came on. Like, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah, well, look, the reality is that on the current Dublin team or squad, only the really, really exceptionally good players make the breakthrough at an early age. For example, O'Callaghan, and he's a ready-made player.
Like Kenny, Jack McCaffrey,
the really top-class players made it kind of into the setup and integrate themselves into the team fairly quickly. But there's no such thing as these guys developing as players. Like, if you're not good enough, you won't play. So what you have is these guys who
Carma Costello.
Yeah.
Like, he hasn't been seen. Now he was injured for a little while, but like, I mean, he can't develop as a player.
He will eventually work his way into the team when he's 23 or 24, and then he'll be a mainstay in the team for 2 or 3 seasons. That seems to be what's happening. But I think that we are looking at an unbelievable manager though as well in Jim Gavin, who has had the vision to kind of pull the whole thing together. And I suppose from the outside looking in, it's an unbeatable combination at the minute. Now, I suppose maybe it is kind of heart ruling head, and that you kind of want to believe that there's a way to beat any team and anybody can be beaten. And you look at the age profile of some of their players and you say, yeah, look, they're kind of coming to the end. And then you look at the strength and depth, and you look at the strength of Dublin club football, and you look at just the volume of players and the standard of competition there, and you just see it that, you know, you would have a scenario where, you know, Dublin club teams probably wouldn't, they wouldn't even entertain challenge matches against club teams in Meath senior, like club teams of Meath that would be challenging for honours. They might only play against maybe 1 or 2 that they would handpick and say, ah yeah, they'll give us a bit of a game. But other than that, they're not interested in taking on clubs from Meath predominantly. So I mean, like, that tells its own story in some way. Like, the top Dublin clubs aren't even bothered with challenge matches against clubs from other counties. Maybe they'd play Roth or they'd play Portlaoise, but that's about the height of it.
Yeah, they're too strong. And again, you have to reiterate, because Dublin can get very defensive about this, and I genuinely don't see why they do. This will only benefit Dublin football in general in the long run. That's like, it's a my short term, right, you're splitting the 2 in half, and you might say, oh, you're splitting half that team there and half that team there, but in the long run you're going to have 2 incredibly strong teams, because there'll be only half the amount of people dropping off. And like, I'll give you an example. Owen O'Gara was one of the worst inter-county players I'd seen when he came on the scene in 2010 maybe. Gilroy brought him in his first year. He was raw. He couldn't solo the ball back up to his hands without it going. Like, he looked like a newborn foal. Like, he was so awkward looking, and he just... Now he's a sensational looking player. Like, and that's through his own hard work. It's through coaching. It's through dedicating time. to spend with him and actually make him into a really good Gaelic footballer. I think he's a machine now, and he would make every other team, every other county team he would make, but he can't show off what he's after becoming because there's lads in the Dublin that are better. You know, just when you see little examples like that, I don't think we're seeing enough of these players. Kevin McManaman, a sub, can't get on a Dublin team. Brilliant, brilliant player. You know, Bernard Brogan, I repeat that because I thought that was lousy. Flynn, back from injury, but he's back a while now, but I think his age profile now, like Alan Brogan, is going to work against him, where these lads should be used. But because these young Conor Callans are coming through, Niall Scully's coming through, these lads are being pushed out too young. We're not getting to see them because you can only pick 15. And that's the frustrating part.
To be fair, they're only being pushed out because the manager feels that the other guys are ahead of them at the minute.
Yeah, and he's keeping it fresh. And
in fairness to him, Jim Gavin is remarkable in some respects. Like every great manager, you know, has their kind of go to men or whatever, has guys they rely upon, but it's always a very, very difficult thing for them to, I suppose, cut that umbilical cord of trust with players that have done it for them on big days. And he's just remarkable in terms of his ruthlessness in that regard.
He's ruthless, and he doesn't matter who he does it with. But what Jim Gavin does well, and what I've heard, is that he doesn't get close to the players. He's always aloof, he's always standoffish, and it's easier to do that then than be the best pal. And you know, I think managers can't be the best pal at times. They have to be like Jim Gavin. But listen, come here, we've gone way over on that. We have loads to get through today. We'll come back in a second and we'll take a look at the Dublin Tyrone game.
Dermot, great to finally get to interview you.
Really, yeah.
Why
is it great?
Why do you not do many interviews?
I don't know, really. I wasn't being asked to do a whole pile.
Really?
Yeah. Have you ever rang me?
I know we spoke about the defensive side of things. If you're coming in and you want to be the Woolly Parkinson and just play for myself, and an inter-county corner forward isn't just patching inside either. Unfortunately for you, Woolly, it won't last forever. You can ask ex-players that. You can ask you know that yourself, Woolly.
Yeah, mine never started at all.
Yeah, well, that's neither here nor there.
All right, Keane, well, let's start off by saying this was a masterclass by Dublin. It was an annihilation of a good team in Tyrone, make no mistake about it. I don't know whether to say Tyrone never showed up, only Colm Cavanagh maybe showed like he had a little bit of heart in him. But were they just chasing shadows? They were just chasing shadows. Their style of play is outdated. Ulster has been left behind because Ulster hasn't moved on with the fact that this ultra-defensive system doesn't work anymore. Its oxygen is turnovers. Dublin are a master. And we said this last Thursday, and it's not bragging about calling this right. We called it right. They will not give Tyrone... Okay, Conan and Stevie didn't. I called it right. They will not give Tyrone the turnovers that they need for their counter-attack game. Without their counter-attack game, Dublin were in complete control. They tracked Tyrone's runners because they weren't counter-attack mistakes, you know what I mean? So Tyrone were just building from a kick-out or something when Dublin were well in position. They never got tricked out and they just were in complete control. They recycled the ball across the field, over back, to the point where, do you ever watch a soccer match and one full-back might spread the play to the other full-back and the crowd all give it the Hill started applauding this moving across the field. Like it was almost like a soccer game. Not a criticism of Dublin. That's what you had to do. They pulled Tyrone out and then they hit them with some injection of pace from McCarthy.
The lads sharing were the boys we spoke about at the start of the show.
yeah. They were the Manchester United fans. But I'd never seen it. Dublin went backwards, they weren't booed. You often see teams being booed, but I think supporters
come to Nav and watch your Meath game, and if the Meath lads try to retain possession and recycle possession, it drives the crowd mental.
The traditionalists don't like it, but I mean that's the only way to deal with this. When Tyrone, it's not an exaggeration to say that when Dublin got the goal, when Conor Callan got that brilliant goal, and it was from a mistake from Sludden, a sloppy hand pass, and Kilkenny that dived in for the break, the game was over. In my eyes, that game was over. Tyrone could not chase that 3 or 4 points on Dublin, and like the rest of it was just immaterial then.
There's a lot in it, and I suppose there's a danger that we go all one way in a one-sided match like this, and we can you know rip up the script on a lot of things. Tyrone's system of play relies on capitalising on the opposition's mistakes, because it's as we say, it's solely about forcing the opposition to make tough decisions in possession. forcing them into pressure situations where they have to make good decisions on the ball. And against the weaker the team you play against, the more likely they are to make bad decisions, the more turnovers you get, the more possession you get, the easier it is to break and score against them. So against a team like Dublin, who are so well prepared, and in fairness, Mayo would be much the same as well in a lot of respects. They've kind of evolved to that level. You would have always associated Kerry with just having a natural intelligence on the ball in terms of making good decisions. But unless you're actually in that scenario against these teams, it can be alien to you. Now, the game has evolved over the last number of seasons. So I think you've been certainly very strong and champion all year that this defensive system will not work, will not win you in All-Ireland, certainly won't win you big games in Croke Park. And I think that has been shown to be true. So you're relying on the opposition making bad decisions. You come against the really top teams. They're top footballers. They're well prepared. They're well coached. They're experienced. They don't make these bad decisions.
Yeah.
So you're conceding possession. You're giving the initiative to the opposition, and you're allowing them to attack you, right? But what you can't do in that scenario, that's all well and good, right? I don't think it's going to work over the course of 70 minutes. But what you absolutely cannot do is make catastrophic, unforced errors yourself. And leave yourself wide open, which is exactly what happened for the first goal, for Dublin's goal. And that was game over.
Yeah.
That goal was game over, yeah. Because Dublin were picking Tyrone off, Tyrone were losing a bit of heart. But the reality was that Dublin were working exceptionally hard. And despite their physical conditioning, there does come a point in a game where a team's energy levels, if they're putting a lot into it, they can just concede a couple of cheap scores, and you will get your chance, you will get your purple patch. Now, what Dublin did brilliantly, and they've really moved it on now, and maybe it was just a thing against Tyrone, but I don't think it is. I think it's a very clear style that they work ferociously hard when they don't have possession in terms of chasing back, and their forwards all hounding back and everybody back with high intensity pressure.
When they get
the ball, they relax in possession. Like, you could see it on so many occasions, somebody would get a sense that, all right, lads need a bit of a break here. You'd see them just, you know, they'd be telling each other to calm down, and they just hold possession. Because how many times have you played in games where the game is helter-skelter, it's up and down, it's to and fro, it's lost all of its shape, and you get a brilliant turnover and maybe six or eight of your lads are after killing themselves to get back and get a turnover, and then the guy on possession drives forward, kicks it away straight away to the opposition, or drives forward and gets turned over yourself, and it just saps the energy from your team even further. So Dublin have managed their energy levels magnificently well in terms of not gassing themselves out. They have incredible physical condition and they're able to just make these good decisions on the ball.
What I was saying a lot on the podcast here is that you need the half forward line because you need to be able to move the ball up so fast before Tyrone get into their defensive shape. But Dublin didn't care about that.
No.
Dublin almost like said, go to them, go on, go back there now and set yourselves up, because we don't care and we're going to play it around and we're not going to give the ball back to you. Like, it went against what I thought, the way you have to play against Tyrone, but maybe Dublin think that if you're trying to be too helter-skelter, you'll make the mistake and then they're back on you again. So I think Dublin have figured out the defensive system so easily and they're so comfortable in it now. They won't bring, like I said, the ball into contact. They'll move it up. Kieran Kilkenny, I predicted two Dublin players last Thursday will really enjoy the game. Kieran Kilkenny, 62 possessions, and Philly McMahon, who was playing centre forward for a lot of the game anyway, so he really enjoyed it. But this was the thing, Dublin just enjoyed letting Tyrone back and saying, right, is this where you think you're comfortable? Well, we're going to take you there. And like you said, that took away the chance of them making mistakes. They very rarely kicked the ball to Mannion, maybe if he's over in the corner and there's no one following him all the way out to there, then they'll move it the whole way back. And then, like, even it was Dean Rock's point from play, like, it was Mannion into Conor Callaghan and shipped it off to Dean Rock on the shoulder
loop, yeah.
All these things are practiced, and I'd say Jim Gavin watched that first half football and I'd say it banished the demons of Donegal in 2014, and he went, like, I'd say his ego grew even another little bit, because I'd say for a manager to watch a masterclass in how to do it, and I think the defensive system now is gone. I think that putting that many men behind the ball is gone. You're gone. And it has been gone. And like I said, that's why I think Ulster are being left behind. The Monaghan have slipped off the radar. Donegal have slipped off the radar, because that's not working anymore. And you could see Tyrone with no plan B. no plan B. And then at and for the second half, they tried to have a plan B. They left Bradley Kavanagh and Peter Hart up there, and sure, they were chasing shadows. They got a bigger beating because they're so used, like I said, to the safety in numbers. So it was just a mess. We said all year Tyrone don't have a plan B. We said that that game plan probably won't work in Croke Park. There's evidence to suggest Ulster football is going down the tubes because they won't give up on this two men up. We called it about Monaghan in the first round against Fermanagh. They're leaving two Ferrari players up front and they're not getting the best out of them because they can't get the ball up to them and they're being double marked. So these tactics are backfiring. All the turnovers were Dublin. Oh, when Tyrone attacked Dublin and Dublin were back in their defensive chasing them back, Tyrone had literally no idea how to get through them. All the turnovers are on Dublin's side, not on the other side. Like, I mean, it's gone. It's outdated now. It's finished. And Mickey Hart needs to realise that they're going nowhere with that. They can still potentially have a forward line of Matty Donnelly, Peter Hart, Sludden, say Bradley, Lee Brennan, who's a class act, only he's no position on that team, and Ronan O'Neill, and have Sludden and Donnelly back working and leave four forwards up. They have to. The new shape now that they're all playing, and that's Mayo, that's Dublin, that's Kerry, that's all the top teams, is they're going with four forwards. They're still bringing back men to help, but you have to leave those four forwards up. And the Ulster teams have been left behind on this, and the sooner they wake up and smell the coffee, the sooner they can rejoin the party.
Yeah, well, look, my belief on it anyway, for what it's worth, is that if you look at the start of that game yesterday, Dublin-Tyrone, there was a lot of ball kicked out around the middle. It was, you know, 50-50 ball around the middle. Dublin won all the breaks and had possession. Dublin dictated the game from there by retaining possession. I've gone on about it before about Tyrone setting the terms of the engagement by how they set themselves up. Yeah. Well, Dublin effectively counteracted that by holding on to possession.
Yeah.
And Dublin were quite happy to keep possession around the middle of the pitch.
There was all A's in the first half.
Knowing that Tyrone eventually have to come and try and get the ball back.
Yeah.
So they eventually have to come out a little bit and they get passed around then and it becomes easy for Dublin.
And just when Dublin were ahead of them, can't you make a defensive team look incredibly foolish and silly? You're behind, mate, and you won't come out to tackle us here. And Dublin didn't care. Dublin just laughed at that system. They laughed at the system.
Yeah. No, well, it was very easy. I mean, it's very easy to play football and keep possession when there's nobody putting you under any pressure. Now, it requires serious energy to chase all of that down. So when Dublin are in that mode and you can't get a hand on, it's very difficult for the opposition. But you have to go out and try and play and try and win a game of football. And the fundamentals for winning football matches is about getting possession. You know, competing for the ball, competing around the middle, trying to win breaking ball. When you get possession, then it's about obviously trying to use it wisely, but set yourself up to score. Like, I think that Dublin's forward play, and again, we were on a bit of on a previous show, like, their forward play is brilliant, because I still don't believe individually that there aren't forwards out there as good and as talented as what Dublin have. There are in other counties. There are players out there, good, intelligent footballers. And if they had Jason Sherlock coaching them, the cohesion with how they move the ball and how they attack and the position to pick up, I don't know if it's for sure it's him, but I have a strong suspicion that it's Jason Sherlock, because there's a lot of brilliant moves, brilliant intelligent football. He was an exceptionally intelligent player with his movement and his decision making when he played, and he definitely has added a huge, huge amount to that Dublin setup since he's gone in there. I think so.
And I think even the patience and recycling the ball, there's a lot of basketball there.
Absolutely.
Let's not give it him, because
they're playing basketball without a shot clock.
We called for the shot clock earlier this year, but I actually don't think we should call for a shot clock anymore, because I think that the Ulster teams are going to have a rethink, and the shot clock won't really be needed anymore, because shot clock's only needed when you have that many men in there. And if they were going to be the tactics going forward, the only answer would be a shot clock, because you have to force the issue. But that would be giving the advantage to Tyrone and not to Dublin, who, you know what I mean, Dublin shouldn't have to force that issue. It looked a bit like Barcelona when they had all the possession and Chelsea were camping and they're just moving it side to side and waiting, like Guardiola always said, move it until you get a mismatch, a 2-on-1 situation. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was mentioned in the Dublin training.
That's what they're looking at. I mean, what they're looking for is, again, resting in possession. So you could see them, they're pressing very hard immediately when they lost the ball. Massive energy. As soon as they turned it over, more often than not, maybe one player or two players would break to get themselves that bit of space, and then they would recycle possession, rest in possession. you know, and Graeme Souness has a great one as well. You know, it's find the dummy. So you keep moving the ball around, you keep moving. Somebody will eventually switch off in the opposition. So it's wait, find the dummy, and then it's your overload, your 2-on-1, your overlap, or the 1-on-1, and you're getting your score.
Getting your score, yeah. There's no doubt about that. And putting John Small and Peter Hart was a great move.
Excellent.
John
move,
Small,
yeah.
So strong in the tackle. He's so bloody underrated, John Small. He'll do a job for you. He's got the heart of a lion. You know, he's a real like it. He's a fan
favourite.
Yeah.
He's a real competitor.
He looks like a Dublin footballer.
Yeah, he does,
like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a kind of an Eamon Heary hard man look to him. Like, he's just built. He's built really strongly, and he has that kind of Dublin cockiness just in him as well. You know, but like, I mean, you can't fault Dublin. Like, it was as good a performance that we've probably ever seen against one of these systems. They just tore apart. Like, their tactics for the kick out was very interesting. They put four along the full forward line.
Yeah.
So that's spread out. So they're immediately trying to cut out that small little scuttery one, or the one going backwards to the corner. So four go across that.
And if you're playing against Dublin, always be wary of the player they're leaving free, because it's a trap.
Yeah. If they're leaving one up, then they go three along the 45, they go three along midfield, and they go three behind them. So it's 4-3-3-3. They leave one man back marking Bradley and of Cluxton, and that's the way they set up for when they push up on the kickouts. Four across the 21, and then 3-3-3, and like, that's their shape, you know, which is like, it's interesting enough. But like, the thought that's put into a lot of this kind of Dublin tactics, like the idea that Jim Gavin tried to put out when he took over first, that, you know, they were kind of an off the cuff team and stuff. That they're definitely not that now. Like, there was times yesterday when Dublin had 14 men behind their 45. Now, in general, Dublin always will try to leave four forwards up. You'll watch them in the All-Ireland against Mayo. 100%, they won't be chasing back unless they're chasing their man. But against Tyrone, it was like, no problem, lads. You want to play that game?
Yeah.
We can play that game. We're flexible. We're just as big. We're bigger and stronger. We're faster. And we can turn you over just as easily. And it was very interesting how one-dimensional Tyrone were. Tyrone were going in ones and twos into Dublin's defensive system and getting turned over.
But like, they were also, Tyrone were running down the centre channel. I mean,
down the centre, yeah. But it's like Tyrone weren't used to this. It's like Tyrone have never really, like, they would have up in Ulster, but like, never a team of Dublin's kind of physicality.
No, it's a terrible thing to say, but it actually looked like it just looked like they were completely shocked by how good Dublin were, how strong Dublin were. They just looked, you couldn't say underprepared, but you know, in a game sometimes it can just happen where you just get hit with this sucker punch and it's complete panic stations, and that's what it looked like for Tyrone, and they never recovered. So to me, how they didn't expect Dublin to be as good as they were amazes me.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. And when you have players like Brian Fenton, you have players like Jack McCaffrey, you have players like James McCarthy, when you want an injection of pace, they're providing that for you. And when they go through, you can be sure there's somebody on the shoulder and there's somebody coming out in the loop. There's constant movement around the man on the ball. And Tyrone had no answer. They had no answer. They had no answer for Dublin's pace, for their patience, for the fact that they didn't panic one little bit. And when Tyrone didn't get the turnovers, they're almost like, shit, we now have to build from the back slowly while Dublin get back.
Yeah, and while we're being put under severe pressure as well.
Yeah, no, look, there's no doubt about it.
Pounded down. The guys that all the key Tyrone players, the majority of the key Tyrone players, were nullified and put under severe pressure when they get the ball. Like, Peter Hart was, every time he got under severe pressure, they were quite happy to, much like Mayo did with Paul Murphy, actually, quite happy to be as aggressive as possible in the tackle with him and foul him. You know, stop the momentum.
Yeah, he got fouled a fair bit. We'll talk about some of the really good performances in performance of the weekend. Kieran Kilkenny was very good. Another thing, it was an interesting thing, and everybody thinks it, and none of us have been involved in intercounty management, and you don't necessarily know the ins and outs, but the whole analysis was, because of Dublin Donegal 2014, that long range points is how you beat a defensive system. And then there's the opposite argument of, that's what defensive systems want you to do, is take shots, because it's low percentage and you might get one or two of them, but you won't continue that right throughout the game. And that's how that match against Dublin panned out against Donegal in 2014. They started off like a house on fire, Connolly and Flynn getting long range scores, but that they ran out of the energy to be able to do that. But there was no long range scores from Dublin. I'm going to analyse the first half, because that's when it was a proper contest and Tyrone were back in with everybody back. They worked it. Like, Conor Callaghan was scoring from the D one or two. They just worked it that well. Paddy Andrews scored a brilliant one from the right-hand side with his right foot. He's a master at doing that. Kilkenny scored one off his right the other side.
The points they were kicking were under absolutely, practically zero pressure. The one really stands out was the Paddy Andrews one. Paddy Andrews was on his own. Like, no one next nor near him. And Dublin hadn't done a lot to create that.
Yeah.
So to me, look, at while I don't believe it that the style of play Tyrone have is going to be successful against a real top class team like Dublin are, they didn't even do it well.
They didn't even
play their own game well,
no.
Which really compounded things, and that's really why I suppose by half time it was completely up, because Tyrone had played their own game really, really poorly and completely were at six in complete shock.
They were in complete shock.
The situation
I think that's why Colm Kavanagh stood out head and shoulders above everyone else, because there was actually a spark to him and he was actually getting out, trying to make diving blocks, trying to do all those things. But I think maybe because Tyrone had so many players to worry about and so many runners that they just couldn't get those bodies around that they usually would. Like, I mean, Dublin would have pushed all of their players up except for Keane O'Sullivan and Johnny Cooper. So it was two against one. Three against one or two against one, the other side, and everybody else was in that attack somewhere. If you weren't in it, you were on the outskirts of it, and you had to be watched. So they couldn't.
Constant movement.
Yeah, always, in, out, yeah, in, absolutely. Out, moving it around. So all these sweepers and these less detailed to double up, they were concerned about someone. So they couldn't really get. Yeah. Like, because you're trying to explain why Tyrone didn't bring it. And like, there has to be, you know, the reason why they weren't swarming.
Well, Dublin rarely take it to contact.
They don't. Yeah. They won't give you that contact, and they won't give you that that energy that they want. Quickly on Tyrone, Keane, because Mickey Hart is saying he expects to be here next year. It's not in my hands. Now, he only got the 1 year extension. Like, I mean, I've nothing but respect for Mickey Hart, and I think that his record speaks for itself. I know Brian McGuigan defended him strongly on the Sunday game last night and says Mickey can stand down when he wants to stand down himself. And I don't know, I would have thought that 3 or 4 years ago, but I'm starting to think now it might be a little bit like Arsene Wenger, where he's gone to maybe the end, and it could do with, I'll give you an example, it could do with a Peter Canavan, for example, who's got a brilliant, brilliant football brain. He's excellent on Sky. He's a Tyrone man. And, you know, give somebody else of that ilk. Now, I'm not saying replace Mickey Hart with a chancer or someone else. I wouldn't get rid of Mickey Hart unless Peter Canavan wanted a job. If Peter Canavan wanted a job, I'd respectfully say to Mickey, just give Peter, he's a legend, and we want to see what he's like, you know, in with the team. Because Peter was telling me at a function last week.
Yeah, go on in your circle.
I was asking about Lee Brennan. Now, this isn't Peter giving out or anything like this. I was just picking his brain. Because Lee Brennan, we all see the videos of him playing club football. He looks sensational player off left and right, balance, everything. And I was saying, how is he not getting on the team? And Peter says he's a little bit slow. And he says, if he's a little bit slow and he's a finisher, where does he get onto the team? Because he's not going to run the line like Bradley. Right, and he's not an athlete. So a class act like Lee Brennan has no business being near that Tyrone team. And I think they're cutting off their nose to spite their face. Like, because of this system that's being played, class finishing forwards. Ronan Neal's not on now. I don't know if Ronan's done enough to prove himself at intercounty level yet. But it's in that system where he's never really had the one on ones where he can turn and shoot off both feet. Like, give some of these lethal forwards a chance, but you won't do that probably with Mickey Hart, because he's gone so far with this system that I'm not sure whether he wants to turn back around and start all over again. We saw how disorganised they were when they just left three up yesterday.
Yeah,
you know,
well, I suppose, like, it's just difficult again. It's very, very hard for me out, and I wouldn't have the in-depth knowledge of the players at the disposal in Tyrone or what you know, what guys are lighting it up at club level, but I would have always just had faith that, you know, you just think a guy like Mickey Hart, that he is devising the best system for the players that he has at his disposal. Now, look, we often are at, you know, various points. I mean, look, me and you could disagree on how good we think a fella is, and if we were sitting down to pick a team, we might have a disagreement over one player, whether he'd start or not. But it's very difficult to gauge, and I don't know who's in his management setup, but I would always think that you need to be constantly, if you're a manager, to be successful at the top level, you need to be bringing in new ideas, and you need to be bringing in the best possible coaches and best possible thinkers that are available. And look, to me, it seems, you mentioned Peter Canavan there. I mean, like, he he seems to have, you know, from watching him on Sky, he's very keen analysis of the game, and he'd obviously have the passion for Tyrone. Like, is it possible, again, you don't know, for personalities sometimes can't work together in the same management team, but like, if Peter Canavan was to be brought in next year along with Mickey Hart, you know, as one of his coaches or something, yeah, like that, I mean, look, who knows? But that to me seems to be a thing that it does appear to be quite rigid, but whether that's all down to Mickey Hart or not, I'm not entirely
sure. Yeah, look, we don't know if Peter would
I'd be very reluctant to be kind of critical of Mickey Hart just because of what he has done, and because the one thing
it doesn't give him carte blanche to get away without criticism.
It's not about that. I would criticize Wenger because his teams are non-competitive, and that's the one thing I would always say about Mickey Hart's Tyrone teams. They always are competitive. They always show a huge degree of fighting spirit and heart. And when a team doesn't have fighting spirit and heart, then the manager needs to go, and needs to go immediately, and should walk himself, really.
Yeah.
But when a team is displaying all of that, I think we can nitpick around that. But is there somebody better that can you know, bring something to the table? And that's up to the county board of Tyrone.
Yeah, it is. And so I think we're all agreed here. Wenger out. Right, we'll be back in a second with Kerry Mayo.
When your legs don't work like they used to before.
I was actually coming home on Saturday morning, and I had the podcast on from Newbridge all night, and that helps the journey, to be honest. If I've ran out of Ed Sheeran songs, depends on mood I'm in. Ed's good for if you're in a sappy mood, Ed's good to sing along to, and then if you're in a GA head mood, which I am probably most of the week, then I turn these boys on.
Darling, I will be loving you till we're 70.
Yeah, brilliant performance by Mayo on Saturday. Always feels an awful lot older, the Saturday game, by now, when you have a huge game the day after. It's almost like, geez, what was happening there again?
It feels
that
like
one?
It was 2 weeks ago. I can't really remember.
It's so far away. But like, I mean, one thing that stood out for me here with Mayo was their flexibility now, right? So they started with Vaughan on Donaghy. Aidan O'Shea started centre-half back keen. Centre-half back on Johnny Buckley, which he went in for the throw-in, then he was marking Johnny Buckley, who was centre-half forward. He dominated the first 10 minutes. Now, I don't know if Mayo got spooked, because Donaghy won the first ball off Vaughan and laid it off to, I think, Lyon, and he kicked a point. And not long after then, Aidan O'Shea went in. So I'm not sure, was this predetermined he's going in after 10 minutes, or did he get spooked by, you know, just a win? But Vaughan was doing fine on Donaghy. He wasn't doing much. And Aidan O'Shea was dominating the middle third. Like, he'd gotten on so much ball out there.
He was driving forward.
Driving him on. And it just actually, like, without getting into it, because we know Aidan did well on Donaghy in the end-up, but Mayo dominated the game completely. But it just proves how much Mayo were missing by not having Aidan O'Shea out around the midfield for those games. Like, you have to say he did well on Donaghy, and frustrated Donaghy to the point that Donaghy obviously ended up getting sent off. So I'd say, if you're to look back at the Aidan O'Shea experiment at Donaghy, you'd say it was a success. It was a huge risk, but as it turns out, especially in the second game where Donaghy got no ball out in front of Aidan O'Shea, that you would say that was a huge, huge risk that I still don't agree with, but that worked for Mayo.
Well, if they didn't have him full back, they would have won the first day.
Well, we don't know.
Now, and I think that even, like, you have to take the game, as John Childs would say,
take the game
on its merits, right? So what you're looking at is a complete dominance from Mayo, physically and around the middle third of the field on Saturday. So it doesn't matter who's playing full forward. If the ball isn't coming in and the guys out the pitch can't win it and aren't able to, you know, set the play up, there's no angle for him to get on the ball. So there was no opportunity for Donaghy. I mean, it's not like Aidan O'Shea was marking him so tightly that he was blocking off his runs and the ball wasn't being delivered, or that he was breaking ball off him. I mean, look, at any ball that he did break off him, you would think any guy worth his salt should be able to compete, because it wasn't like there were quality deliveries.
It wasn't good ball.
There was a number of occasions where in the game, there was one stage in particular in the second half where Donaghy walked round Aidan O'Shea along the end line, and Donaghy then somehow found himself drifted forward late into the attack and was inside the Mayo defence, 5 yards in behind everybody, totally unmarked for at least 30 seconds, you know, with no one on him. So I don't agree that it worked. I think I'd still stand by my view, of which is that it's a bad move, but it didn't matter because Mayo were so much better than Kerry.
Yeah, so much better all over the field.
And also Keith Higgins' role, he was good at shadowing and covering in front of that of that low ball
we'll get to Keith Higgins now then, because Keith Higgins, Kerry handed Keith Higgins the easiest job he's ever going to have in his life, right? So let's talk about Fitzmaurice, because Keith Higgins was outstanding in that sweeper role. Now, because Kerry gave him the free role. The week before, Keith Higgins could only half do it because they brought on Jack Savage and brought Keith Higgins out. And then, you know, so we talked on Thursday about the motivation behind playing a sweeper and why Kerry wouldn't go again because they trusted their full forward line. So what did he do? He dropped James O'Donoghue, right, who, fair enough, had a poor game against Galway, which you'd say grand, but that game was like a challenge game. And I'd say some lads come alive in the heat of battle. Some lads might want to clock up scores when it's handy. Like, I'd see Stephen O'Brien sticking over 1-3 when the game is over by 10 points. You know, that kind of way. Not saying that he doesn't do it in the battle either. But, like, I mean, you look at this,
I know the point you're making. You wouldn't want to be relying on him in a big game to get a score for you. Whereas, you know, O'Donoghue, even if he's having a bad game, will ask questions of the opposition defenders. He makes his movement. He does a lot of movement. Now, oftentimes I think it's nearly, he's, you know, making, it's too much. He's going into bad positions, or he's not a threat, really. He's kind of going down blind alleys. He's very predictable. But at the same time, he's still asking questions. He's forcing defenders onto the back foot. He's making them defend.
Yeah.
The first score he got when he came on was just, no one else would have got that electric score.
But, Keen, this was the thing. And he didn't play great the last day in the rain. It didn't suit his style of play at all. The lack of a half forward line meant he was winning it out too far. There's a lot of mitigating reasons why we talked about this on the Monday. Is that good enough reason to drop James O'Donoghue and play a sweeper and handy initiative?
If I was playing a sweeper, I would have dropped Donoghue and I would have played O'Donoghue and Gainey inside. If you're playing two up and you know that the opposition are going to bring a big man back to take out the threat of the high ball in, what's the point of having somebody up there who's not going to cause much other threat outside
of that? It was crazy. So what they ended up doing, obviously, was they brought Thomas Sullivan on, and he marked Kevin McLaughlin, and then they put Paul Murphy as a sweeper. Paul Murphy's a man mark. Paul Murphy will do a job for you. Paul Murphy's not a sweeper. Like, he was actually at sixes and sevens as a sweeper. Like, there's a skill to being a sweeper. And number two, a sweeper is redundant, because I'll tell you why. Mayo's deliveries into that full forward line, and we, pretty sure we talked about last Monday or it was last Thursday, Andy Moran is now getting the ball in positions where he's turning and he's shooting. Andy Moran always used to get the ball out by the wing and he was never able to shoot. He was running himself into the ground, being that man to break. The ball now is coming diagonally from the wings, that Andy Moran's getting it in the D. A sweeper can't mark diagonal balls. Like, if you want to predict a diagonal ball, a sweeper only cuts out the obvious ball. If a sweeper starts trying to double bluff a diagonal ball, they'll just give the easy ball and he's gone. So he has to hold the easy ball line. If they give a diagonal, the sweeper's useless anyway. So what were Kerry thinking based on the balls the week before Mayo were given into these lads? How was Paul Murphy meant to intercept these brilliant long diagonal deliveries?
Yeah, and also a lot of the time the main benefit of a sweeper, aside from maybe cutting out the pass, which, as you say, good footballers don't kick the ball to the sweeper in the first place. And Mayo have enough good footballers to not kick it to him. So the second thing is
to double up.
Your sweeper picks up, but he also picks up the break that your cornerback knocks off the forward. So the ball that usually they compete with and they fight for it together, and the ball breaks and then it's a battle to get it, your sweeper always picks that up. So that's the second benefit of having the sweeper in there. But the Kerry full back line, like Enright, was just absolute. I've never seen such a roasting in two games by a man on the same fella. Never seen the like of it. And just complete panic stations from a defender, making daft decisions, diving in on Andy Moran. Like, of all players, like, Andy Moran, we all know, is an excellent player. His movement is superb. He's brilliant on the turn. He can kick points off left and right. But he's not an Olympic sprinter.
No. So don't dive in on him.
So you don't dive in. You stand off. You stand about a yard off Andy Moran, so that you're close enough that if he's going to try a shot, you can, you know, unless it's a brilliant score from Andy Moran, you're going to be close enough to get in and have an attempt at blocking, or certainly put him under serious pressure. But you don't let him inside you.
No.
You don't fall for his first dummy every single time. You don't dive in when the ball is coming for a ball you're never going to get for the second goal. He was never going to get that ball in, right? Never, ever going to get there.
Yeah.
Lunging in. Crazy stuff. Now, look, it happens. Players are low in confidence, or they're panicked, they're a bit spooked, and this can happen to them. But the sweeper was redundant. The basic defensive instincts of Enright particularly was not good enough, and that's really, like, they were so badly exposed there.
Enright actually lasted a full game, 39 minutes, and 2-6 was scored off him. before Eamon Fitzmaurice moved, put him out of his misery and took him off. Now, there's an argument. Enright is their man marker. So when your man best man marker is getting roasted, what do you do? Put a lesser man marker on it? You know, so I can, in a way, I'm making an excuse for Fitzmaurice because you have to make that change.
Sometimes a change just makes a difference.
Styles make fights.
Yeah.
So there's definitely like an argument for saying get him off at like 1-5. So starts him on him the next day after 1-5. After looking at that video, analysing that, and then leaves him score another 1-1 off him before he takes him off. Enright didn't have the size. He didn't have he just was second best in that matchup the whole way through, which is a very surprising one. Even Jack Barry from the start. Well, Jack Barry's better than Anthony Maher. Geez, the injection Jack Barry gives when he comes on is a nightmare, and we talked about that. Mm-hmm. That. I don't know, even that didn't look like the right move. You know, I thought the Thomas Sullivan one and not starting James and Donoghue, it's just the most un-Kerry thing to do. And it was all things say, oh, Kerry, you know, everyone does tactics, you have to do tactics. But like I could tell you, this is not hindsight, I could tell you the minute I heard James O'Donoghue was dropped for Thomas Sullivan, they're playing a sweeper, that's a huge mistake, was the first thing that came into my mind. Most people would say that, so I'm surprised Eamon Fitzmaurice went down that road.
Yeah, very, very surprised, particularly when we spoke about the whole reason that he went about his game plan the first day. What we felt was to keep, not give Mayo the initiative and let them attack on you. I mean, everybody knows that Mayo's strongest area of their field is breaking from their defence, their half back line, and you know that athleticism and that running power. So to just hand them the initiative and say, you know, come and attack us, but to not even get into a full defensive shape. I mean, it wasn't as if, like, you kind of do one or the other. You can't half do it, and that's Kerry looked a little bit confused.
Yeah,
would be the way I would kind of describe
and, like,
it.
I mean, here's the thing about Paul Murphy and the sweeper is because it's such a specialised position, and because Paul Murphy's a tagger or he's a lad, how can you just play that role out of nowhere? How can a team start playing that role out of nowhere? So they were totally confused. Donegal Walsh played and he clearly wasn't fit, so he was a disaster. Johnny Buckley wasn't at the pitch of the game either at all. Now they had to try and make an offensive substitutions, and they brought on Darren O'Sullivan, who actually looked like he was the right man for that job.
Have to talk about his black
card.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about that in a minute. I'm going to leave Goff until the very end here. There's one or two things because, like, I mean, I want to talk to you about Goff a little bit because he's from Meath, but he lives in, we know he lives in close to St Jude's, so Kevin McManaman was nicely in his ear for that 45 in last year's All-Ireland final. Kevin McManaman was, David Goff actually overruled his umpire on a 45 that his umpire got right because Kevin McManaman came up and shouting at him that it was a 45. Can you actually believe that? And he's a teacher in Kevin McManaman's local area. I've known that, they're all facts. There's no opinion put in there. Everything I just said there, which you're laughing at, is all actual factual information. Yes, yeah.
It just goes to show, we always prove it's just a GAA conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy. We're all against the Dubs. But now the thing about this is Mayo's rotation, right? So Lee Keegan played centre forward for a while, he played wing back for a while. Paddy Durkin played wing back, played centre forward, came on centre forward. Aidan O'Shea is now centre forward, midfield, full back. You had Dermot O'Connor, he got that goal from full forward, he was rotating into the full forward line. I was outside looking for interviews, I asked someone in the Mayo management team, was Dermot O'Connor injured, and he said no. So Dermot O'Connor was taken off because of form, but I thought maybe because he was injured they were leaving him in the full forward line maybe to, you know, to rest or something like that. That was a tactic where he was moving in beside Killian for a little while, in beside Andy for a little while. Now they got the goal, it was a fluke because it was a miskick point. But at the same time, without him being rotating in there, how would he have been in there to get that goal? He was specifically in there for a while. The point I'm trying to make is Dublin don't know what to expect from Mayo the next day. Rochford is so brave and his players are so flexible that there are so many different things that they can do. And if you try to get the matchups, which Fitzmaurice is well known for wanting the matchups done, if you want matchups and you're going to be rigid and you're going to be Jim Gavin saying you're on him, you could end up anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Because if they're going to start, the best thing to do when a manager loves matchups, rotate your players and drag his matchup men into places they don't want to be. You know what I mean?
I
think Mayo have that flexibility.
Drag a corner back out to wing back or
and Jack McCaffrey corner back. Yeah. And if Jack moves back out, then bring your man back out. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just play with them a little bit if they want to do those matchups, because most managers like matchups. And if you have flexibility and players that can play everywhere, move them all over the place.
Yeah, no, it's going to be very intriguing. But I think, while we touch on it, like, The Mayo Kerry game was, despite the fact that there was some kind of strange moves from Kerry in the first half of that game, I think was the score was 1-7 to 4 points at half time, something along
Kerry
those
were at
lanes
six.
At. Yeah, something
1-8 to 6 or something.
I think it was about six, 5 or 6 points in it. But Mayo got three incredibly soft frees in the first half, and I know Kerry got soft frees the first day, but Mayo got maybe three what I would consider to be very soft frees that Killian O'Connor stuck over in the first half, and their goal was a fluke. So despite being completely dominant and everything going in their favour again, they should have been in at half time a lot tighter than what it was. Now, on a different day, and Kerry performing a little bit better, the Darren O'Sullivan black card was an absolutely ridiculous decision when it was Killian O'Connor who actually blocked him off,
yeah,
and should have got a black.
Darren just continued his run through,
and it
him.
Should have been a free out. So I mean, like, all of these things added to scores and added to just the whole disruption to Kerry and things just not going their way. Mayo were by far the better team, but Kerry can consider themselves, I think, to be a little bit unlucky on a number of occasions as well.
We don't have time to talk about the kickouts. Kieran Whelan did some good analysis on the Mayo kickouts. They changed that up. That's another thing they're flexible about.
They go short a lot.
Yeah, they go short a lot, but they also bring everyone into the middle and leave loads of space either side. Now, that's pretty easy for Jim Gavin to analyse and mark the next day. But they won't go. They might not go with that the next day. This is the thing. So because, like, I mean, I was surprised Kerry fell for such an old basic move, because Dublin are doing that for years with Shane Ryan and Kieran Whelan. Long time ago when I was playing, they had them in the middle and they're leaving space. So you mark them from the outside. Mark them from the wing side. But Kerry fell for it because it's not easy. There's so much going on in a game. It's very hard to make all the change. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd imagine as a manager, there's so many things going on in your mind. So that's the unpredictability of Mayo now. You know, and that's number one, their players. You don't know where they're playing. Number two, they can move their kickouts. Rutcher is a brilliant thinker of the game, and I think this is what could be an extra string to Mayo's bow. McLaughlin at wing forward is obviously a huge plus, which they didn't have last year. They gave Dublin the sweeper last year, where they won't give them the free sweeper this year. Loads of things that are in Mayo's favour, but obviously Dublin are like an absolute machine. But we'll get on to Goff. You talk to me about Goff, because I don't like Goff as a referee, if I'm being completely honest. I think he's into himself. And that's not, you see people joking on Twitter about, oh, his hair is gelled and stuff like that he's clearly into himself. I'm not talking about his appearance. I'm talking about the way he refs games is clearly into himself, because he wants to be the talking point. My point on referees are nobodies in the bigger scheme of things, and that's, I don't want that to sound really disrespectful to referees, but in the bigger scheme of things, when you look at players and the efforts they put in, when you look at managers, when you look at supporters and everything they put in the game, a referee is really, a lot of them haven't often played the game. They're actually supporters themselves that are just lucky enough to be in there to facilitate a good game. It's not about you. You just keep that game ticking over and nobody talk about you. Every time Goff refs, we talk about him. It's like he wants that. It's like he needs that. Like, he's blowing fouls off the ball that are never picked up. That's clearly in my head him thinking, oh, I'll get great credit for this, trying to clean up the game and clean. Like, there was lads pulled up in the Connacht final for just being touched tight. That's not a foul. Like, what Paddy Durkin was sent off for was outrageous. A lad holding his jersey and boxing his arm away and a bit of pushing. Bullshit. It's not. That's nothing. Like, I mean, that's being talked about. The Darren O'Sullivan thing was an outrageous decision, which he got wrong, whether he saw that or not, whether it was a linesman.
Because
Darren O'Sullivan
went
crazy at the linesman, and that's in Goff's defence. I just see the freeze he gives by trying to be clever. I see all the things he does trying to have the focus on him looking like a clever referee. And I'm here to tell Goff, you're not as clever as you think you are.
Yeah, well, he reffed the first round of the championship, and he blew me up for over carrying the ball, and it was a terrible, terrible decision. I kicked a point out after it, so he wouldn't be in my Christmas card.
But how's he seen in league then?
The way it is, it's sometimes it's very difficult. It can be unpredictable. Like, there's obviously referees with different sides. He hasn't refereed a huge amount of our championship games, probably because he's off, refereeing inter-county games or whatever. He might be around the county scene. But if you compare his style to, say, somebody more like Cormac Riley lets a lot of stuff go, lets a lot of aggressive tackling go, which, oftentimes that's kind of what you want in a game. You want the game to be played that, look, if it's a foul, it's a foul. If it's harmless enough, let the game flow and let the game move on. So I think there was a little bit of inconsistency. I thought that, it looks like he referees the game slightly differently in the middle third than he does in the final third, because there was lads being nearly killed around the middle of the field, and there was nothing happening. I mean, it looked like you could get away with a hell of a lot of aggressive tackling in the middle sector of the field, and it seemed to be innocuous enough type stuff to get a free on the inside line. And
but when you start being that finicky on the inside line, where does it stop then? Like, I mean, you actually have to continue that all the time, and then you.
Look, it is difficult, but I wouldn't give him. I wouldn't be critical of a referee who's keeping an eye on the cornerback pulling and dragging inside, because
no.
We won't see a bit of that.
But he's pulling for a lot less than pulling jerseys. Like, if I played in the full forward line and the full back line, I appreciate a ref if a lad's dogging your jersey of calling it in. That'll soften the cornerback's cough. But that wasn't the case always in the Connacht final when he was doing it. He's blowing things for like really innocuous stuff, which like a bit of like wrestling together or pushing away. Like if a cornerback's touch tight and holding your shoulder or pulling, like a cornerback can kind of grab your arm as you're running. You know, they're not they're not necessarily fouls. Like,
well,
I mean,
they're soft.
They're very soft.
Yeah, soft. So look at. I don't know, like I suppose I don't get really into analysing the performances of referees too often.
I hate doing it.
Or monitoring them on a over a number of games to see if there's a pattern in how they referee or whatever. So what I would say is that I thought that some of the calls at the weekend, and whether they were Goff or whether it was his team that were involved with him, I'm not entirely sure. But the Darren O'Sullivan one was a really, really bad decision. It looked like that was the linesman's call. The other call on Durkin was strange. I thought Crowley's second yellow card was completely bizarre as
Unbelievably
well.
Soft. There was nothing in that. And Boyle didn't even fall backwards.
So I'm just not entirely sure. Again, was it a case that Crowley had committed 5 or 6 fouls and he'd given him 2 or 3 warnings before he was giving him the second yellow, and eventually said, look mate, I've given you 4 bloody chances here and you're continued to foul, you have to go eventually.
Wasn't even a foul that stopped Boyle. Didn't even break his momentum.
I'm trying to play devil's advocate a bit here. I would say that it wasn't his finest performance.
And you look back
weekend.
At that Crowley one, Kerry were back within 4 when he got sent off. Like, that was a big stage of the game, because, like, I mean, number one, Mayo have thrown away leads like that against Kerry before.
Darren O'Sullivan with his pace and everything, there was 4 points. I think they were right back in it maybe when he got the black card as well. So it just unfortunate that we're talking about it is probably the best way I could describe it.
Yeah, but and then you wonder, does he want you talking about it? Because if he didn't want... this is the way he sees the game and he has a philosophy on the game and he wants to bring that in. I don't know, but I tweeted at the time, he's the ultimate forwards referee. That, like, I mean, if you're in the full forward line, I don't know that he ever played football, but he was in the full forward line if he did, because he really has a bee in his bonnet about little silly fouls in there.
Do you know what I'd be very interested in as well is, what are kind of the directives? You know the way we have all these things that the adjudicators or the board of referees are kind of looking to see what's going to happen, or they're talking about certain things. Like, what's the marking criteria for them, for referees? I mean, like, I'd like to see something like that out in the open, because, you know, what is... I mean, if top of the list is, are we talking about the referee after the game? And if the answer is no, he's had a brilliant performance. Maybe that should be top of the list, because ultimately that's what it's about. Like, the game is about the flow of the match and the game being played and the rules just being implemented by the referee. That's what they're there to do, not to impose their personality or their philosophy or their belief system in on the game.
Yes.
It's about strict application of the rules, and some people will like that and some people won't, but ultimately that's what his job is. So if it's very clear, like, if a referee is, if you pull a guy's shoulder off the ball, or if you pull his jersey or any of that, if he's every single time consistently given a free for them, then there can be no complaints, because it's obvious what he's doing, everybody knows about it. And if that sort of consistency is brought throughout the pitch, you can say you could be criticised for being whistle happy, but the referee can always say, here's the rule book, lads. My job is to implement this, and that's what I'm trying to do, and I'm trying to do it to the best of my ability. And I'd just like to see the criteria, because we don't really know. You know the way there's sometimes every year they have these sort of fads that a rule is, they're very hot on something for a short while and then it seems to go away.
I think though, why would the GAA give a huge game like that to somebody who's finicky and whistle happy? Nobody wants to see that. Like, who is it, an assessor that wants that? Technically he'll whistle everything. because fans don't want to see it. The spectacle doesn't gain anything by it. The referee becomes the centre of attention. He's involved in too many high profile incidents. Fellas get sent off. Well, what good comes out of having a finicky referee? Like, I mean, O'Reilly, like you said, lets things go. I have universal praise for referees that let things go. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants the players to express themselves, no one to get dogged out of it, but the game not to turn into a constant talking points about referees. I can't understand what excessor would give Goff a big game when you know that it's going, Twitter will be in meltdown about him, everyone's going to be talking about why is this lad giving these frees. Like, I mean, and you could argue all day whether technically frees, we all understand the game enough to know what's let go and what's not let go, and you mean let the players express themselves. That's the one thing I would message I give to any referee, let the players play, let them play. Do you know what I mean? But be forceful. And like, I mean, one thing in his defence is that Kerry versus Mayo, there was a bit of niggle to it compared to the first game, and there was a few markers being laid down. So maybe he said, I'll get a few yellows out here early doors and I'll put manners on them. When he did that, he went down a road where he just had to, you know what I mean, maybe continue that, or I don't know. Like, again, never been inter-county managers and we've never been referees, yeah. So I don't know. But I definitely do think instinctively that Goff referees the game, you know, with the intention of being in the game himself. Do you know what I mean? And being involved in the game a little bit. Whether that's fair or unfair, you can only call that as your honest opinion. We'll be back in a second with AIB's Player of the Weekend.
Is the little dink fist pass from a crowded area into that D we're talking about, where Bernard, I've talked to Bernard about, Bernard's very patient. But this little dink ball, you know, the one in a crowded area where it's a fist pass, the weight is taken over, hits the ground, and it bounces into a fella's chest, and there's consternation then in around the D and in around that area. Watch for this in the semis and the final. Do you know the one I'm talking about? That little fisted ball that's just in a crowded area, but it gets to the
yeah,
body.
You have said it three times.
It's in around it. But you're looking at me. You're looking
well,
at me.
Out of a crowded area, isn't it?
You're looking at me with such a confused head in you. It's like I was talking about you trying to get a point in coppers or something there in a crowded area. Yeah, watch for it.
AIB, back in club and county.
All right, AIB's performance of the weekend. And we did a poll on the website for this. The four nominations were Colin Boyle, Paddy Andrews, Jack McCaffrey and Conor Callaghan. And as probably comes as no surprise, the Mayo fans are out in force, and Colin Boyle has got 62% of the vote, Paddy Andrews 3, Jack McCaffrey 5 and Conor Callaghan 30%. So on the website, the clear winner is Colin Boyle.
62%, longer than the minutes he gets in a game usually.
yeah. Although he got over it at the weekend. The reason I put Paddy Andrews in is because the game was in the melting pot against Tyrone, and he was the outstanding forward Conor Callaghan was the outstanding forward, then Paddy Andrews. Paddy Andrews is the most underrated player in the country. The only reason Paddy Andrews isn't the story of this Dublin team is because there's so much brilliance around him. If Paddy Andrews was a forward in any other county bar none, he would be their marquee forward, he'd be their most consistent forward, and I mean that. Maybe Paul Geaney being the exception with Kerry, but if he was on the Mayo team, he'd be their main man up front.
He's kind of a similar style even to Andy Moran in terms of his clever movement, and he's kind of short steps in his stride. He's really good on the turn, and he's able to get shots away
and
fast.
The ultimate team player Paddy Andrews is. He's no problem going saying, look, I'm your sidekick, I'll make runs for you, I'll make you look good. And all the time while he does that and does everything for the team, everything he does is for the team, he'll still score points from play. He scored 5 from play against Mayo, was it last year in the drawn game? Or the year before in the drawn game. He's a sensation. And this is a fellow who played cornerback under Pat Gilroy. Think about that, a quarterback, to be as accurate as he is. I really, really like him playing. I really think that without him, the Dublin forward line wouldn't be anywhere near what it is.
No, I think he's excellent. He's a very, very clever footballer, always has been. And I would totally agree with that assessment in terms of his importance to the forward line as a group. I think he's kind of goes back to my point. Paddy Andrews doesn't, there's nothing spectacular, doesn't do anything spectacular. Everything he does is very functional, sort of by the book, doesn't make too many handling errors or mistakes, shows hard for the ball, works hard off the ball, and has an ability to get scores under pressure. And in fairness to him, he has done it really when the game has been in the melting pot more often than not. Like, he puts in the real shift in these games, and then the guys come off the bench when they're marking a guy who's hardly able to run, and they rattle in the scores and get maybe a bit of the glory. So he's a hugely important part of the jigsaw for Dublin.
He is. Conor Callaghan, the big question about Messi always is, could he do it on a rainy night in Stoke? I suppose the GAA equivalent, can he do it against the mass defence of Tyrone?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is a very definite yes. His goal was a thing of beauty. There wasn't a goal on when he picked up the ball at all.
If
that was me, I wouldn't be thinking goal there, but he did. Without Dean Rock's support run to pull, I think it was McCrory or someone, away from him, because when he sidestepped McNamee, he made a fool out of McNamee with a sidestep, a beautiful, really exaggerated sidestep. And then you still think there's not a goal on. But because Dean Rock took his man with him, or the extra defender with him, Med Conn had a shot on, and what a brilliant finish against a really good shot stopper in Niall Morgan. So it's just a brilliant, brilliant goal all around. His 2 points, like Stevie McDonald was on here one Thursday, Keane, and he was telling us the big mistake a lot of forwards make when they're shooting at the goal is that they shoot at the goal. If you saw a man away, if you're kicking a pass to a lad in the middle of the field and your back is to the goal, 9 times out of 10 you'll curl it within 2 or 3 yards either side of him. But when you're shooting at the goals, lads kind of freeze and think, shit, I'm shooting for a point, and their accuracy isn't anywhere near what their foot pass accuracy is. Conor Callaghan passes the ball over the bars, like Stevie McDonald coached him into how to do it. He never drives it over the bar, he passes it over as if somebody's standing on the top of the goalpost and he's passing it into their stomach. That's how he kicks points, and it's a beautiful thing to see for such a young player.
Very, very relaxed style, and
such relaxed.
Like I remember seeing him playing colleges football in Parnell Park a few years ago against St. Pat's from Navan in a game, and he was excellent. He was just a dominant player on the field that day, and you know, in a game where I would know a lot of the St. Pat's lads, and you know, quality players, but he was the man that really dominated the game, and. You know, I've kind of been keeping an eye on him since then in terms of his, you know, minor form at Dublin, obviously now into under 21 into the senior grade. And look, he's just an exceptionally good footballer. He has the physical attributes. He's definitely, I suppose, he's been involved with that senior squad for at least since last year. So he's had that physical preparation as well. He's obviously a powerful guy. He had the frame to put that bulk onto, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And he's breaking tackles there. But he's hungry. Like that's one of the things, to have a new player like him with his talent and ability and that hunger as well, that drive. When he picked up that ball, there was no goal on. It was a break. It was, you know, maybe he clipped the ball over the bar. Like, showed such ruthless efficiency.
Yeah.
Step inside, brilliant sidestep. And what I loved about it was no intent whatsoever to look for a guy to pass the ball to. Got through, saw the opportunity, completely ruthless, and had the quality to do it. You saw Paul Flynn in the second half in a somewhat similar scenario, maybe not as good of an angle.
Jack McCaffrey, was it?
No, when Paul Flynn got through and drove one at the goals and was saved, he ended up getting a point, but he didn't have that same ruthless efficiency as a real natural forward in that scenario, where Conor Callaghan was able to just manoeuvre his body to create a better angle for the strike. He was able to, you know, the support runners helped, but so single minded, so ruthless, and he's been huge for Dublin, and you can see why he's the dominant, probably the dominant forward there for them at the minute. Like,
yeah, absolutely brilliant. Didn't celebrate the goal, which I would like to have seen, but we talked about that. That's probably not his choice. You'd like to have seen him given the fist to the hill there, and really, because what a feeling that must be to score a goal like that into Hill 16 in an All-Ireland semi-final for a man that's only 21 this year. Jesus, put your fist up there, Con. But look, listen, I don't think he's much of a showman. I think he's just like, he's almost like the exact type of player. He's like heaven for Jim Gavin, as in airs or graces, a very level-headed young fella who won't get ahead of himself. He's not going to be plastered across all the buses around Dublin, and you know, like,
not for another 3 to 4 years.
Well, listen, he should cash in on a couple of nice kind of
gel in the hair,
nice Nivea sponsorship deal or something he'll be getting. So Colin Boyle, Jack McCaffrey, obviously brilliant, but like, there isn't that much more we can say about Jack McCaffrey other than
he's sensational,
blinding
though.
Pace, brave, everything about him. He's a fan's favourite. He's just like, he's, because I have a huge graph for attacking wing backs. I haven't been one myself, but he's the best I've seen like since Paul Curran.
The thing about Jack McCaffrey is you'd actually go to watch a Dublin game where you'd tune in, and all you'd want to do is say, lads, just give it to Jack and go on a run here.
He'll make something happen.
Yeah, just when you see him sauntering forward, and then you know you're just waiting for him to
turbo.
To put the turbo on, and it's it's exceptionally exciting to watch, and he comes across as well. I suppose it's not overly important really in terms of performance, but he comes across as a very, very likable kind of a guy as well.
Yeah, he
and
is.
I suppose being out in the cold and that last season for Dublin, he's come back in this year and he's been the main man again for
yeah,
him.
He's very, very likeable. He's huge likeability, Jack McCaffrey. Colin Boyle, obviously, man made of steel, leader, drives the team on, saved certain goals. I think he's the heartbeat of this Mayo team. There's no doubt about that. He's literally made of steel.
He's a warrior.
If you're a warrior, if you want leaders, if you want fellas who won't shirk under pressure, if you want fellas who you know you're guaranteed a good performance. Now, he won't mark his man that tightly, but he'll win breaks and he'll get turnovers and he'll do all those things. He's not a tight marker, but that's not what he's there for. He's there as an absolute warrior, and like, teams need that. Like, I actually can't remember. I remember before County Final, there was one Portlaoise lad in particular, I always used to say, you block the ball down, you don't understand the lift we get. It's a specialty of his. Do you know what I mean? It's like somebody doing something that is their specialty is as big a lift as a goal, or like, okay, not as big a lift as a goal because that's a three pointer, but a forward kicking an inspirational score, you think that's inspirational. It's also equally inspirational as a fella doing a diving block, if that's what they're known for, and that's their way. Lots of different lads have ways
going
of
going in and winning that hard breaking ball.
They have ways of lifting the team, and everyone has their own speciality. And like, I would be lifted massively by a fella known for blocks or turnovers, getting that block, because I say, he's at it. Now, you know what I mean? The rest of us are at it. He's brought what he's good at. Now I have to bring what I'm good at.
It's a trigger to the team, and Boyle really, he does. He drives on. He's just. You know, passion embodied in terms of the way he plays. You know, it's just, it's all heart, it's all grit, it's all determination, and it's matched with a fair degree of plenty of ability as well.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. A mention for Paul Flynn, who came on for Dublin and looked like he was 25 again. I thought he was sensational, and he's going to give Jim Gavin an awful lot to think about for the final. Keith Higgins, who's sensational but given a free role. Tom Parsons, I thought, battled really, really well and won the midfield battle. Dave Moran didn't have one of his better games. But performance of the weekend, we're going to give it to Conor Callaghan. Because when the game was a contest in the first half, he scored 1-2. I repeat, 1-2 against the defensive system. He scored arguably the goal of the season so far when you take everything into consideration. And he's only 21. He's not 21 yet. So we're big fans of Conor O'Callaghan on the show. We'd like to get him on the show, but that might not be possible. So that's all we have time for. Jeez, we're back to a final. So we might have a two-week break before we get to the final. We might do a podcast next week made up of a few stories and stuff like that. It won't be a regular preview show, but we'll do one show next week at some stage, and we'll talk to you then. Good luck.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
But these fellas, they get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their houses for 10 years.
The GAA Hour with Colin Parkinson is sponsored by AIB, proudly backing club and county.